strictly extra credit. Some of the most memorable moments my students experience do not happen in my class, and they are not required activities. For example, when studying the West in the Gold Rush, we learned about an amazing entrepreneur named Sam Brannan. After hearing about the unbelievable way he became rich without ever mining for gold, I put forth a challenge. Sam Brannan is buried in San Diego. Bring me a picture of you with his gravestone. I have had literally hundreds of students over the years search through the Mount Hope Cemetery and return with pictures. I like to give them activities that seem like missions, and they enjoy getting together with friends and tackling the challenges. The granddaddy of all my extra credit challenges is the March to the Sea. As part of a lesson on the impact of the automobile and how it has transformed our sense of space and time, I ask students to estimate how long it would take to get from my room to the beach. After they guess anywhere from 20 to 40 minutes, I inform them that I mean by foot. They have no idea, so I say that I challenge them to test it and find out. They have to touch my door and then put their hand in the ocean. It takes them about 7 to 10 hours. They, all on their own, I might add, form into teams and show up on various Saturdays and Sundays throughout the second semester and head off as early as 5 in the morning. They often come up with names for their groups and even design t-shirts or wear matching clothes. The Bull Moose Party, the Tribe, the Neon Turtles, and Team Song are examples of their creativity at work. This is absolutely amazing if you think about it. Many students, including some who don't even want to come to school on a regular day, show up on a Saturday at 5 in the morning to walk for 8 hours. Part of the magic created by the safe zone of my class is the sense of camaraderie that forms among students. Over time, they get excited about conquering an insurmountable challenge with a team. The explorers collect souvenirs along the way and bring them back to my class the next week. They sound like old war buddies reminiscing about their adventures. It's an experience they will never forget. Students will do amazing things if you could design a class and an environment that is positive and empowering. Rising up to and overcoming challenges, building lifetime relationships, and forging positive connections to school won't directly result in better test scores. It will result in better people. Isn't that what we're really trying to accomplish? This isn't fantasy football. Most of my friends play fantasy football. I've always resisted their peer pressure and refused to join in. Nothing against it, just don't want to spend the time. However, one of the dads started a kids league in the neighborhood and my son joined. I watched the first games of the season with my son and his friend as they followed their players. It definitely changes how you see the game. My son's friend Robbie is a huge Chargers fan, and I watched in disbelief as he cheered after an incomplete pass from Philip Rivers to Vincent Jackson. We were losing the game, and it would have been a touchdown for our team. But Jackson and Rivers were on his opponent's fantasy team. He was actually rooting against his beloved Chargers because the stats of individual players have become more important than the game. In fantasy football, a player's worth is solely based on their individual statistics. Much of what makes a player great and helps a team win doesn't show up on the stat sheet. The block that set up the winning touchdown? Forget about it. It wasn't my guy who scored. Mindlessly and obsessively tracking stats can lead to a shallow view of the game. As a basketball coach, I love to watch the player who rotates to provide defensive help, sets the proper angled screen to free up the three-point shooter, and blocks out the other team's leading rebounder. Unfortunately, the majority of fans watching the game, and everybody reading the box score in the paper, miss these crucial elements in the win. Statistics just can't properly measure the impact a player has on the game. The exact same principle holds true when we turn school into a twisted version of fantasy sports and overemphasize standardized testing. An intense focus on test scores can lead to a shallow and narrow view of what is important. I refuse to boil down the educational growth and development of my students into a statistic. Much of what is truly significant in the long run just doesn't show on the stat sheet provided by test scores. For example, I would much rather my kids leave my class with the strength of character and courage to fight racism when they find it than have memorized some facts about the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I'm not saying you can't have both. I'm just pointing out that only one of those things will be measured on the test, and it isn't the most important one. Why have so many schools reduced the time and emphasis they placed on art, music, and physical education? The answer is beyond simple. Those areas aren't measured on the all-important tests. You know where those areas are measured? In life. Art, music, and a healthy lifestyle help us develop a richer, deeper, and more balanced perspective. Never before have we needed more of an emphasis on the development of creativity, but schools have gone the exact opposite direction in an effort to make the best test-taking automatons possible. Our economy no longer rewards people for blindly following rules and becoming a cog in the machine. We need risk-takers, outside-the-box thinkers, and entrepreneurs. Our school systems do the next generation of leaders a disservice by discouraging these very skills and attitudes. Instead of helping and encouraging them to find and develop their unique strengths, they're told to shut up, sit down, put the cell phone away, memorize these facts, and fill in the bubbles. This isn't fantasy football. Education shouldn't be about raising statistics. It should be about raising and fulfilling human potential. Focusing on the stats leads to a lost perspective of what is truly important, the game. Oh, and by the way, in the game I'm talking about, we're all on the same team. Part 3. Building a Better Pirate. The Awkward Question. Life is too short to be small. Benjamin Disraeli. Do you want to be safe and good, or do you want to take a chance and be great? Jimmy Johnson. Do you want to be great? When I ask this question in my workshops, it is most often met with awkward silence, nervous shifting in the seats, and avoidance of eye contact. Why is it such an uncomfortable question for teachers to answer? We admire athletes who want to be great. In fact, we get annoyed and disappointed with athletes who don't have the drive to fulfill their potential. Yet, it's so hard for teachers to admit aloud that they want to be great. Could it be that wanting to be great seems egotistical or selfish? Let's destroy that idea right away. First of all, your greatness in the classroom doesn't negatively impact or inhibit anyone else's opportunity to be great. This isn't a zero-sum game. The pie is infinitely huge. In fact, your greatness only enhances the opportunities and possibilities for others. By being great, you are raising the bar and providing a model for others to emulate. Being your best possible self contributes to the school culture necessary to create the environment for greatness to flourish. In addition, your greatness with your students trickles down to all teachers who have contact with these same kids in other classes in other years. They will leave your class a more well-rounded, self-confident, competent, and positive person. In our profession, the old saying is true: a rising tide lifts all ships. Being truly great requires a significant amount of extra time and effort. It demands a relentless pursuit of excellence, self-improvement, and a never-ending commitment to grow and stay on the cutting edge. After you put in all of that extra time and effort, how much more will you see in your paycheck because of it? Zero. That's right, not 1 cent more. So who then benefits from your greatness? Your students, your school, and your community all benefit. Ultimately, the world becomes a better place because of your greatness. Therefore, in our profession, striving for greatness is the ultimate act of unselfishness. We are in a service profession, and there's nothing egotistical or selfish about wanting to provide world-class service to our clients. I think another reason people feel uncomfortable saying they want to be great is the group dynamic. I'm sure a certain portion of my audiences want to say yes to the greatness question. Unfortunately, the snide comments and eye-rolling of their peers keep them from admitting what they really want. People who are comfortable and accustomed to traveling with the pack, always riding in the middle of the peloton, often resent those trying to escape in search of something more. After all, riding in the peloton saves up to 40% of your energy due to less wind resistance. Breaking away, on the other hand, requires a huge burst of energy and enough strength to avoid getting dragged back to the pack. Believe me, plenty of people will try to drag you back, but that's why you must have a goal worth fighting for. Mediocrity doesn't motivate. To ascend to the level of greatness, you have to be on fire with passion and enthusiasm. Mediocrity is incapable of motivating. You just can't be on fire about mediocrity. There's no energy, juice, and no fuel to action. How could anyone be fired up about creating a lukewarm classroom environment where kids punch the clock, mostly behave, and then file out the door to the next class? Teaching is a tough job filled with unbelievable hardships, hurdles, and headaches. Our profession has a notoriously high burnout rate. Unless you find something big to care about, you won't make it. Seeking greatness, on the other hand, is a journey that can ignite, stoke, and continuously fuel a raging inferno. That journey begins the instant a teacher chooses to shift his or her mindset and says, "Yes, I want to be great." While far from being egotistical or selfish, seeking greatness does indeed have personal benefits beyond the humanitarian ones. The decision to pursue excellence, as a teacher and as an individual, transforms teaching into an amazingly fulfilling and rewarding profession. Suddenly, it's easy to get out of the bed in the morning because you are motivated by a mighty purpose. And at the end of a long, full day, you go home feeling more energized than when you started. I know this to be true because I see teachers not only at my school, but all over the nation who love their jobs because they are committed to be great. Among the general public, there's a misconception that education is completely broken and teaching has become a lost art. They hearken back to some non-existent perfect time when things were different. Those who hold this opinion are wrong. They don't see the same teachers I see, teachers who are unbelievably innovative and doing stunningly fantastic things in the classroom. We don't want to go back to the overly institutionalized, industrial-style education of the past. That outdated, damaging, don't-smile-until-Christmas mentality can and should vanish forever. We're skyrocketing forward into an educational landscape that is changing every day. In these exciting times, we must be ready to take on the challenge of redefining greatness for a whole new generation of teachers and students. The mighty purpose. The media propaganda against education and teachers has reached a fever pitch of ridiculousness. It doesn't faze me one single bit. It rolls off me like water off a duck's back. I rarely engage in a debate, and when I do, I never get confrontational or lose my temper. Why? It's simple. My purpose is too mighty to be dragged down by negativity. I just can't afford it. What I'm trying to accomplish is too significant and game-changing to allow anything to slow me down. When you have a high enough calling, it's much easier to commit yourself to doing whatever it takes to accomplish your life's purpose. You have to decide if what you're doing is worth your complete effort and full attention. If it is, don't let anything stop you. The word decide has an interesting etymology. It means literally to cut off. When you truly decide, truly commit, you are cutting off all other options. Making a decision about your life's purpose isn't something to be done lightly. I love what George Bernard Shaw said in Man and Superman. "This is the true joy in life, the being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one, the being thoroughly worn out before you're thrown on the scrap heap, the being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances complaining that the world won't devote itself to making you happy." Note that he didn't say joy results when your purpose is recognized as mighty by political pundits, radio talk show hosts, and outsiders. He said it had to be recognized by yourself. Stop looking for external validation. Sure, it would be nice for society at large to put the proper value on what we do, but notoriety isn't necessary for greatness or fulfillment. We know teachers today are doing more with less than at any other time in recent history. Our profession isn't broken. In the circles I frequent, there is more energy for propelling the profession forward than I can ever remember. I can think of no higher purpose or calling than teacher. We help shape the minds of future generations. We have the ability to literally change the world. How then can anyone possibly hope to measure the extent of our greatness? With more statistics, right? Not really. But that's exactly what current teacher evaluation models rely on to quantify teacher effectiveness. Such methods are hopelessly flawed. You can't measure a teacher's impact through standardized test scores or DF rates. A teacher's impact can only be measured through generations. I like the coach who, during an end-of-season interview, was asked if he thought his season was successful. He paused a moment and replied, "I won't know for another 20 years. That's it. We aren't just teaching facts to memorize or skills to learn. We're uplifting lives and helping students fulfill their human potential. We're shaping the mothers, fathers, world leaders, entrepreneurs, and artists of tomorrow. Anyone with the most rudimentary understanding of geometric progression realizes that our students will interact and influence millions. It's a mighty purpose indeed. That's why I agree with Shaw's comment about wanting to be thoroughly worn out by the time this life is over. I don't have time to be tired. When you're doing great work, you have a moral imperative to become the force of nature Shaw refers to. I don't want to play small. I want to be larger than life. Teaching is a poker game that must be played all in. Don't allow anything to stop you. Be willing to have, as Malcolm X would say, a by any means necessary attitude. Don't hang around negative people. They will sap your superpowers as sure as kryptonite. If people could only see what we do, they would realize we are modern-day superheroes wearing the Clark Kent disguise of teacher. Do you want to be great? Absolutely. Our purpose is too mighty for anything less. Play your drum. Little Drummer Boy has been my favorite Christmas carol for as long as I can remember. Of all of the holiday songs, I can honestly say it's the only one that truly moves me. The idea of a young boy, too poor to afford a fitting gift for the newborn king, attempting to honor him with what he does, is a great lesson for all of us. We spend too much time stressing out and concerning ourselves with what is absent in our lives, and not enough time focusing on what really matters. The drummer boy may not be able to afford expensive and fancy gifts, but he has something better. He can offer the gift of his unique strengths and talents. He has no material gift to offer, but what he can do is play his drum like no one else is capable of playing it. And so he does. The fact that his play is met with approval and acceptance from Mary and the animals is certainly of no surprise. After all, when one is engaged in pursuing one's passion and offering the very personal gift of doing what he does best, the power is undeniable and clear to all. Isn't that what life is really all about? We all have to find our own personal drum and then play it the best we can. For me, I never feel more truly alive than when I'm standing in front of a class of students or a seminar room full of teachers. That's my drum I'm playing up there, and I'm going to play the heck out of it. The line, "I played my best for him," is a call to arms and a challenge to meet. Forget all the things you can't control and play your drum to the best of your abilities. Play with all the passion, enthusiasm, and heart you can muster. Nothing else really matters. You can offer no finer gift or higher honor to the world than to find out what your drum is and then play it for all it's worth. Where do I start? Everyone who got to where they are had to begin where they were. Richard Paul Evans. The great end of life is not knowledge, but action. Thomas Henry Huxley. Hopefully you have found this book inspirational. At the very least, I hope you've discovered some ideas you want to apply to your teaching. Where and when should you start applying them? Right here and right now. Starting may well be one of the most difficult and underappreciated skills of all. The world is filled with examples of people who never achieved what they wanted because they overestimated the difficulty of it and never even bothered to try. You will find that taking the first step is very often the hardest part of the journey. The single most difficult part of writing my blog posts is sitting down at the computer and opening up a blank Word document. Once I've done that, half the battle's over. The hardest part of working out on a regular basis is getting to the gym or leaving the house for a walk. Working out actually makes me feel incredible. The only really difficult part is starting. So what holds us back? What keeps us from starting? The answers to this question probably number in the thousands, if not millions. That said, the five below are the most common reasons, and they're all conquerable. 1. The fear of failure. Quite simply, some people don't start what they know is in their best interest and what they really deep down want to do because they think their efforts will be wasted in failure. Why pass up that piece of cake and go work out when I know I'm just going to quit like every other time before? I don't have the ability to learn how to use all this new technology, and even if I do learn it, it will just change again. My kids would never participate in these crazy classroom activities. This self-defeating attitude and lack of self-confidence destroys all forward progress. You can't grow, advance, and move forward without repeatedly stumbling and falling on your face. If, as toddlers, we went into the process of learning to walk with our adult mindset, we would still be crawling. You have to be able to push through the fear and bring your work into the world. Life isn't 100% or fail. The madness of the 2011 NCAA basketball tournament ended with Butler University shooting the ball worse than any team I've ever seen in a championship. It was a legendarily bad game, and like any losing team, Butler received a fair amount of criticism. Honestly, all of the Twitter comments about the failure of Butler's team made me sick. Are you kidding me? A small school comes out of nowhere to make the championship 2 years in a row, and the people piled on because the team lost both times. A low-seeded underdog making the finals 2 years in a row is one of the most amazing accomplishments in college basketball. But because our culture lives by the philosophy that you either win it all or you're a failure, the team was trashed. Don't buy into this BS. It reminds me of when the Bills lost 4 Super Bowls in 4 years and were labeled by many as embarrassments and failures. Hello? To lose 4 consecutive Super Bowls, you have to go to 4 consecutive Super Bowls, which is an unbelievable accomplishment. As a San Diegan, I follow the San Diego State University Aztecs. This team had never been in the top 20 and had never won an NCAA tournament game. They finished the 2011 season with 34 wins and 3 losses. They were ranked 6th in the nation and went to the Sweet 16. Still, after losing to UConn, some claimed it was all for naught. One team wins and all the rest are losers. What a misguided and dysfunctional way to look at the world. Do you want a guaranteed formula for disappointment in life? Set up the rules of your life so you have to win every time or have 100% success in order to feel fulfilled. So how does this apply to teaching? During a recent new teacher training, a second-year teacher asked me a fantastic question. After watching me demonstrate lots of student engagement strategies and techniques, she asked, "When you use these strategies, do you have full engagement from 100% of your students?" I said, "Okay, I'm going to tell you the real deal. No. What I have is more engagement than I would have had if I didn't use these techniques." She then shared that she feels unsuccessful when she tries to add creative and engaging presentations because some students still don't get into it. I think many teachers set themselves up for failure this way by making it a 100% or nothing game. I always strive for total engagement, but believe me, I have behavior management problems in my class too. Students sneak in texts in their lap. Kids stare out the window. Striving for excellence and full engagement is about getting better. It's about adapting, adjusting, and trying to tweak and improve everything you do. It's not about beating yourself up if you don't attain some unreachable level of nirvana-like perfection. An all-or-nothing mentality exasperates the fear of failure. If you believe everything you do has to work 100% of the time, you are less likely to take risks and step out of your comfort zone. I often say, if you haven't failed in the classroom lately, you probably aren't pushing the envelope enough. You're being too safe. I had the pleasure of working for John Wooden for 3 summers at his basketball camps. One of his wise sayings was that the team that makes the most mistakes usually wins. That sounds counterintuitive. The truth is, the team that makes the most mistakes is the team that is going for it and actually doing something. Playing cautiously is a recipe for failure in sports, business, teaching, love, and just about everything else. To reach the highest levels of any pursuit, you have to be willing to fall on your face. It seems everybody is piling on teachers right now. We have become fashionable targets. Honestly, I don't let it bother me, and you shouldn't either. Success isn't something that is bestowed upon you by an outside source or a test score. It doesn't come from winning the championship or going undefeated. How then can we define success? I think John Wooden said it best. Success is peace of mind, which is a direct result of self-satisfaction and knowing you made the effort to do your best to become the best that you are capable of becoming. He was a wise man. 2, believing you have to figure it all out before you begin. Nobody has it all figured out. If I felt I have to have it all figured out before I started this book or my original seminar, I wouldn't have done either. To win in the classroom, you must develop the ability to take leaps of faith. The cost of having a lesson plan fail is low. Nobody's going to die if we experiment in the classroom and it doesn't work out. If my surgeon decides to experiment during my operation, that's different. If a lesson plan fails, you show up the next day and you make it right. More importantly, The cost of failure is far lower than the cost of standing still and losing out on all hope for progress. Teaching is like being on a steep, smooth-sided mountain. If you stand still, not only will you fail to reach the summit, you will actually lose ground. Unless you are constantly climbing and striving to move forward, you're sliding backwards. And even though you can't see the impact you or your class will have on your students 20 years up the road, that's okay. You don't have to be able to see the top of the mountain to know that you can only get there by moving forward. 3. Perfectionism. Perfectionism can paralyze. Some people don't want to act until the time is perfect and all the bugs have been worked out. Demanding perfection keeps these people from producing anything of significance because, obviously, perfection is an impossible goal. It is far more important to be prolific than it is to be perfect. I believe in adhering to the wedding photographer principle. It would be outrageous for a wedding photographer to not take any pictures all day while waiting for the perfect shot. What do? They take hundreds of pictures from every possible angle and with every possible group. Since the pictures are digital, the cost of each additional one is negligible. Then, you get the freedom and flexibility to choose your personal favorites. You are far more likely to find great pictures when there are hundreds to choose from. The same is true for your educational creations. Kill the inner critic that blocks your creative flow. Surrender your search of the holy grail of perfection. Create freely, liberally, and in great quantities. Doing so relieves any one idea of the need to be perfect. How will you know what the best ideas are out of so many? If you can't figure it out on your own, trust me, the world will let you know. That brings up another point about relenting on your need for perfection and putting yourself out there. Unless you send your work, your art, out into the world, it doesn't count. In his book Linchpin, Seth Godin refers to this concept as shipping. Quote, shipping something out the door, doing it regularly, without hassle, emergency, or fear, this is a rare skill, something that makes you indispensable. End quote. In my inner circle of colleagues, we use this word ship to keep each other accountable. We cajole each other to continue to do the work. You can either talk about all the great things you're going to do, or you can actually do them. There is no in-between. As Steve Jobs said, real artists ship. What have you shipped lately? 4. Lack of focus. Time is our most precious commodity, and it is definitely a finite resource. Therefore, we just can't do it all. Too often, we fill our schedules with minutiae and seem too busy to accomplish our goals. We play this trick on ourselves. It's what Steve Pressfield calls in The War of Art, the resistance. Subconsciously, we know if we keep ourselves busy and overscheduled, we won't have to face the great work we know that we should be doing. We have to do what Stephen Covey described as putting the big rocks, your priorities, in your jar of life first. The less important things can fill the extra time. Just don't allow them to steal time from your priorities. Realize that anytime you say yes to something, you are saying no to something else. Learn to say yes to the significant and no to the projects and activities that diminish the time and energy you need to fulfill your major purpose. 5. Fear of criticism or ridicule. You can fear it all you want. It's still coming. I'm constantly surprised how desperately we seem to crave the approval and permission of other adults and will use the lack of it to justify inaction. Criticism and ridicule come with the territory if you're going to try new ideas and be proactive rather than reactive. You'll get stuff wrong, make a fool of yourself, and many will give you grief for it. You'll also grow, find ideas that do work, and leave the armchair quarterbacks in the dust. Don't let critics steal your soul. First some background, then a rant, and finally a point. At the end of my World War II unit, I give a full lecture on the decision to use the atomic bomb on Japan. I display supporting pictures, give arguments from both sides, and show documentary footage of the aftermath of the explosion and radiation. This includes extensive survivor interviews and footage that had previously been suppressed. We discuss the moral implications of using the bomb, as well as the military arguments. We ponder questions such as, Do the ends justify the means? Did dropping the bomb actually save lives by immediately ending the war? Finally, I tell them about Sadako and the Thousand Paper Cranes. It's a story of a young girl from Hiroshima who slowly dies in the hospital from leukemia as a result of the bomb blast. She desperately tries to fold a thousand paper cranes so her wish to become well will be granted. The story is emotional and is a powerful moment for the class. At the end, I tell them of the monument honoring Sadako that is in the Hiroshima Peace Park and the inscription that reads, "This our cry, this our prayer, peace in the world." I bring out a garland made entirely of a thousand small cranes and then tell the class that to honor Sadako and innocent victims of war, I will teach them to fold a paper crane. The last section of the Sadako Day is spent with me leading them through the folds. Every student leaves with a self-made crane. Okay, there's the background. Now comes the rant. We just had a WASC, Western Association of Schools and Colleges, accreditation visit at our school. The visiting team was well-led and left with a positive impression of our school. All things considered, it was a meaningful and productive process. But, and this is a big but, one thing happened that got my blood boiling, and it has taken a long time to let it go. One of the visiting committee members came into my class during the last 10 minutes of the Sadako lesson as I was leading the class through the final folds. He approached a student sitting on the counter, yes, we have more students than seats, and asked what class it was. Upon hearing that it was U.S. history, he looked around and said judgmentally under his breath, but loud enough for multiple students in the area to hear, "What does this have to do with U.S. history?" He then walked to the back wall and left after a couple of minutes. What does this have to do with U.S. history? Are you kidding me? This guy comes into my class for 3 minutes and sees something totally removed from any context and then drops that line? Let's forget about how unprofessional it is to say something like that in front of a group of my students. I can get over that because they all thought he was a complete idiot. They knew exactly what it had to do with U.S. history. If he really wanted to know, he could have asked me or any student in my class instead of making a misguided, arrogant judgment and leaving just as ignorant as he entered. Later, I learned that in one of the final leadership meetings, an English teacher was criticized because students were drawing a picture of a Greek god as a part of a project on mythology. The comment was, "Is that really an example of rigor in an English class?" Yeah, God forbid that we incorporate artistic elements and creativity into a class outside of the art department. Next thing you know, kids might start enjoying school and become well-rounded individuals. I know I'm going to get into trouble with some of you now, but let's be careful with this word rigor. Here's how Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary defines the word. Harsh inflexibility in opinion, temper, or judgment. Severity. The quality of being unyielding or inflexible. Strictness. Severity of life. Austerity. An act or instance of strictness, severity, or cruelty. A tremor caused by a chill. A condition that makes life difficult, challenging, or uncomfortable. Wow, I don't want any of these definitions to describe my class. The only good thing in the whole definition is the word challenging. Harsh inflexibility in opinion? Severity? Cruelty? A condition that makes life uncomfortable? No thanks. I know. That's not what educators mean when they throw that word around. Nevertheless, I think it's important that we clearly and carefully define what we mean by rigor. I hope it doesn't just mean a bigger workload for students. It had better not mean more hours of homework or classes that are just harder to pass. If instead, rigor means improving higher-order thinking skills and offering students the opportunity for meaningful and challenging work, then I'm all for it. More real-world applications? Sounds good. A lot of people who use that word have never bothered to look it up. I also think that some people have no idea what meaningful and challenging work is. After all, creativity is one of the highest forms of thinking, but some educational reformers don't want students to have an opportunity to express it. They see it as a soft skill, not rigorous enough. We clearly have some work to do. Now let's move on to the point of this story. You will be criticized. In fact, the more you step outside of the box and reject the culture of conformity, the more of a target you will become. When criticism comes, take a moment to evaluate it. Is the criticism an opportunity for growth? If so, learn from that instruction. But realize, too, that your critic may have no idea what they're talking about. In that case, ignore it. You have to have the intestinal fortitude, self-confidence, and personal power to press on and do what you know is right for your students. Don't allow misguided and ill-informed critics to steal your enthusiasm for innovation. If you let them, they will sap you of the strength needed to persist in this brutally tough profession. You have to learn how to take a punch, bob and weave, and keep moving forward. What you do as an educator is too important to let somebody standing on the sidelines prevent you from being the absolutely most powerful teacher you can be. Some people will just never get it. That's okay. That's their problem. You can't let it become yours. I don't think anyone has ever said it better than Teddy Roosevelt. Quote, "It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming. But who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat." End quote. It's easy to stand against the back wall and be a critic. Meanwhile, the rest of us will keep wiping the dust, sweat, and blood off our face because we're in the arena. When in doubt, take action. Thinking will not overcome fear, but action will. W. Clement Stone. The best way to overcome fear is to take action. The more action you take and the quicker you take it, the better. The best way to solidify your commitment to achieving your goals is also to take action. The best way to overcome the obstacles on your path to greatness is to build up enough momentum through action that you can roll right over them. The law of inertia states that an object at rest will stay at rest unless a force acts on it, and an object in motion will stay in motion unless a force acts on it. To overcome inertia and start moving forward, we must exert great force. Once we are in motion, we are more likely to stay in motion. This is especially true if we build up speed and momentum. If you have to stop a car from rolling down the street, would you rather it be rolling at 2 miles per hour or 60 miles per hour? If it's rolling 60 miles per hour, it will roll right over the top of you and keep going. We want to be rolling 60 miles per hour towards our goals so that obstacles in our path get steamrolled and our distant memories in the rearview mirror. The reason many people get held up by problems and obstacles is that they haven't built up enough momentum. Take your foot off the brake and step on the gas. I have seen people take 20 minutes to get into a pool. First one foot, then the other. Standing around complaining that it's too cold, gradually they move a little deeper. I have also seen people walk right over to the pool and jump in. Fear, analysis, paralysis, and lack of confidence can make what should be simple and quick turn into a torturous and drawn-out process. Just rip off the bandage, suck it up, and move forward with consistent and massive action. Finding a crew. I not only use all the brains that I have, but all the brains that I can borrow. Woodrow Wilson. All pirates travel with a crew. You can't sail, navigate, and fight battles all on your own. One of the most rewarding parts of teaching is the personal and professional relationships we develop on our voyage. I am the teacher I am today because of the relationships I have developed. Having a diverse crew is in your best interest. Don't be limited by your subject, grade level, school, or even profession. Take counsel from a wide variety of people and seek out multiple perspectives. Look for opportunities to hone your craft and find educators willing and open to engage in meaningful conversations about the work. Read widely about education and related fields and attend conferences whenever possible. I always leave conferences feeling energized by both the new ideas I hear and by being in the same physical space with others who are dedicated to improving themselves. You might make a connection that will last a lifetime. The power of social media means no teacher need feel isolated. For example, I'm a part of a huge group of educators who regularly connect on Twitter. I have daily access to incredible professional development resources by tapping into my professional learning network, PLN. I participate in multiple educational chats on Twitter. I started with the hashtag SSChat, which is comprised of a fantastic group of social studies teachers from literally all over the world. The TLAP hashtag, which stands for Teach Like a Pirate, is the community gathering place for discussing ideas from this book. I am at Burgess Dave on Twitter and always ready to connect and collaborate with educators. No matter what you teach or at what level, you'll find great teachers and administrators talking about it on Twitter. Feel free to connect with me if you need any help getting started. If you're on Instagram, you can find us at @DBC_INC. Becoming a connected educator is a game changer and could be just what you need to propel yourself to the next level. Collaboration versus killaboration. And that's collaboration, C-O-L-L, versus killaboration, K-I-L-L. I strongly believe in the power of collaboration, but I don't believe the final goal of such work should be to come to a single right way of teaching. Collaboration can make all contributors better teachers as they are exposed to others' ideas and have a chance to draw on the collective intelligence of the group. Collaborative environments can challenge your thinking and push you to places you might not have reached without the support of your peers. However, I have also seen collaboration used to force conformity and stifle creativity. It's a fine line. I like to think of collaboration as a type of mastermind group, as described by Napoleon Hill in his classic book, Think and Grow Rich. Hill defines a mastermind group as, quote, coordination of knowledge and effort in a spirit of harmony between two or more people for the attainment of a definite purpose, end quotes. He further says that, quote, when a group of individual brains are coordinated and function in a spirit of harmony, the increased energy created through that alliance becomes available to every individual brain in the group, end quotes. He doesn't say that every individual will start thinking alike or come to any one single answer, but rather that each individual will be able to function at a higher level through their harmonious participation. In contrast, if the way collaboration is set up, driven, and monitored on your campus does not contribute to it being accomplished in a spirit of harmony, it will not be effective. Wonderfully creative, innovative, and practical results can come out of the collaborative process. Therefore, increasing communication, thoughtful conversation, and opportunities for educators to interact and collaborate should be a major goal on your campus. Let's just be sure that the definite purpose of collaboration is improving education, not simply standardizing it. Be wary of people selling complete programs that will supposedly solve all educational problems. I believe there is no single answer for how to fix our schools, but that we should take the best ideas from everything that we can find. Classroom Kung Fu. Bruce Lee is probably the most famous name in martial arts history, but most people know little about him other than what they have garnered from watching his movies or hearing about his untimely death. Lee was a true visionary who transformed the martial arts landscape with his revolutionary style of teaching. I believe we can learn a lot from this master. Lee was trained in the classic Wing Chun style of Kung Fu, but in 1967, he broke away from it and created his own philosophy, which he called Jeet Kune Do. He felt that martial artists were artificially restricting their options by blind adherence to a particular style. Lee believed the most effective and practical plan would incorporate the best elements from multiple styles. He railed against the endless repetition of beautiful and flowery forms, completely outside the context of how these moves work in the real world. He was unconcerned with how pretty a move was. He only cared that it was effective in the real world. An actual combat situation is messy and unpredictable. As we know, classrooms are the same way. Great teaching gets messy sometimes, and we have to constantly be aware of the changing landscape in our rooms and make moves based on what works, not on what is necessarily theoretically ideal or, God forbid, scripted. Great teaching, like a fight, can't be scripted. Occasionally, I watch professional development sessions and get the immediate sense that the presenter is great at doing the classical forms, but would get their ass kicked in front of a real class. Sorry to say it, but you know I'm right. Not to say that they have nothing of value to offer, but their real-world moves could use some work. Districts and schools always seem to be investing in the latest, greatest program to solve all of their problems. It doesn't work that way. No one program contains all of the best answers, just like no martial art style contains all the best moves. The best martial artist may take a throw from judo, a kick from taekwondo, and a strike from karate. Likewise, teachers should not allow themselves to be pigeonholed by some particular doctrine or program. Instead, we should always be seeking to add more and more effective moves to our teaching style, regardless of the source. Sometimes outside forces try to lock us into a particular style. Sometimes we do it to ourselves. Confession time. For years, I gloried in being the non-tech guy and quickly rejected opportunities to incorporate more technology, saying, hey, it's not my style. That attitude is just like the martial artist who rejects a practical and effective move because it's not part of Wing Chun or whatever style to which they belong. Bruce Lee was right. Sometimes labeling and declaring a style places limits on your growth. He was fearful that his followers would do this to Jeet Kune Do and constantly admonish them to not be concerned with the name. Have you limited yourself by blindly following a style or program? Are you training students to do beautiful and perfect repetitions of classical forms completely removed from real-world applications? In a real fight, you don't just start doing your moves in the prescribed order you learn them. Likewise, we don't want students who can just spit out facts, formulas, and equations. We want students who can take what they've learned and intelligently apply it to the real world around them. Stay fluid, keep learning, and keep up the relentless search for what is most effective. Feel free to leave some of your classical training behind. Teachers and students could both benefit from adopting a Jeet Kune Do philosophy in the classroom. Finding treasure. Once you've done the mental work, there comes a point you have to throw yourself into the action and put your heart on the line. Phil Jackson. I feel completely blessed that you've chosen to take this journey with me. As I've traveled to conferences, keynotes, convocations, and campuses, I have been overwhelmed by the passion, enthusiasm, and kind receptions I have received from educators. Ours is an absolutely amazing profession filled with talented people who make me proud to call myself a teacher. If this book has inspired you, encouraged you, or helped you to find some educational treasure, I would love for you to share that with me. Hearing your thoughts and experiences with trying these ideas in your classroom helps to make this all worthwhile. You can contact me anytime at dave@daveburgess.com, and please feel free to sign up for my free email list at daveburgess.com. Signing up gives you access to featured content and will ensure that you receive additional Teach Like a Pirate ideas and motivational messages. You can also find information about all of the other amazing professional development books we publish at that website or at daveburgessconsulting.com. It all started with Teach Like a Pirate, but now we have over 60 incredible books that we publish to help teachers and school leaders excel. Thank you for helping to spread the word about the Teach Like a Pirate book and philosophy. I hope to cross paths with you as we explore uncharted territories and brave new adventures. Thank you for listening to the audio production of Teach Like a Pirate. Text copyright 2012 by Dave Burgess. Production copyright 2018 by Dave Burgess Consulting. No portion of this recording may be reproduced without the prior written consent of the publisher. For more information on other books and audio products from Dave Burgess Consulting, visit daveburgessconsulting.com. Teach Like a Pirate was recorded at Verity Productions in San Marcos, California.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.